My guest today is Jim Stock. He's a professor at Harvard University and a lecturer at the Study Center Gerzensee. Today, you will find out how Jim experienced his time on President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors and how he compares doctoral courses at Harvard with the doctoral course he's currently giving in Gerzensee. My name is Fabio Canich. I'm a monetary economist and I'm your host today. Welcome to the show, Jim Stock.
Well, thanks, Fabio. It's my pleasure to be here.
Jim Stock, in 2013 and 2014, you were a member of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Can you share with our listeners how you learned that you were considered for this position?
Well, it was a bit of a process. I mean, they need to make sure that I'm, a trustworthy, upstanding citizen and a reliable source of information. So it was a bit of an ongoing process, but it was incredibly exciting and a real honor to be able to be a member of the council for him.
Would you just get a phone call from the White House?
It evolved over a series of phone calls with the White House, yes.
And what were your first thoughts when you heard that you should be working for Obama?
It struck me as being a really exciting opportunity. There were a lot of challenges that the economy was facing at the time. So this was 2012, 2013, when we were having these conversations, and the economy was still in the early stages of recovery from the financial crisis. So there were lots of macroeconomic challenges that we were facing. And I was also interested in many of the energy and climate initiatives that the president was engaged with, and this was an opportunity to participate in that as well.
You're famous for being an econometrician, but now you're doing climate economics. We'll get back to that in the second half of the talk. But let's stay just for a second with Obama. When you first met him, how did you feel? Were you nervous?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I'm not so sure. I think that when I first engaged in a meeting with the president, and I believe this is actually the first time that I met him in person, was a couple days after I arrived on the job. And I went to a large meeting. There must have been 30 people in the Roosevelt Room in the White House. It was quite full, a couple of cabinet secretaries, very senior administration people. And it was on a topic that was not especially up my alley, but I was there. And then the president just had an issue, had a question, which had to do with a very recent economic development. And he said, "Do you think that's going to cause a recession?" And of course, most people had no idea. And he looked at me and he said, "Jim, tell me what you think. You're new here. What are we going to have, a recession or not?"
What did you tell him?
I said, of course, the usual economist thing, which in hindsight was kind of dumb, which was, it depends. But it depended on how severe the shock was that he had in mind and what the thresholds might be. And I tried to give some quantification to that off the top of my head.
You're saying it. You briefed President Obama on a variety of topics, including macroeconomics. How are these briefings organized? Would you give like a big talk, like in a conference, or would you have one-to-one meetings, lunch meetings with the president?
It really depends. So certainly one thing that happened was fairly formal briefings with maybe 10 or 15 or 20 people there representing different groups. And so we would be representing one set, which is the economic analysis side of things. Other people would be representing other sets. And then the president would have a briefing on a topic. And usually that would lead to some sort of decision or some sort of update. But there are other circumstances in which the briefings were much smaller.
You told me before we started the recording that you briefed him, like you wrote a couple of pages and he read it all, and then you would have in-depth conversations. What was your focus when you met with President Obama?
Apparently every president has a different style. I've only had the opportunity to interact with one, with President Obama. His style was very, very much that he wanted to be prepared. He wanted to have a short written material beforehand, which he could digest and ask questions about. And then the conversation typically skipped over a presentation of the written material and went straight into the questions that he had so that he could use his time efficiently.
You worked for the White House in 2013 and 2014, but of course you'd only become an advisor to President Obama because you had had a great career prior to that. In the late 70s, you studied in two of the most prestigious universities in the world, in Yale and in Berkeley. Then in 1991, that was only when I was 3 years old, you became a professor at Harvard. Now you're 67, if I'm not mistaken, and you're one of the most famous economists in the world. When did you first realize that you'd become a world-leading economist?
Well, I tend not to think about those sorts of things very much. I have to say, I tend not to think about things like fame or whatever. I tend to think about what sort of important questions to work on, what's an important set of things to do, what sort of responsibilities do we as economists have to help the world be a better place, and let's focus on our research.
You're saying you don't think about fame, but you must be aware that you're famous.
I think at times it's useful to have people have a little bit of name recognition, because if there's some point of view that you want to convey, that you feel it's important to convey, it gives me both a responsibility but a platform to do that.
What's the greatest downside of being well-known?
I think some people can let it get to them, and you don't want to let that be an objective.
Has that happened to you? Or when did that happen to you?
I tried to avoid that happening to me. I think it's really important to keep in mind that opportunities that one has, opportunities that one has been given, are actually responsibilities to do the right thing. So there's this saying, to those to whom much has been given, much is expected. And that is something that drives my life. It's driven my professional life. It drives my personal life. I've been fortunate, as you pointed out, to have a great education. I've been fortunate to have great jobs. I've been lucky to have great co-authors. And now I have a responsibility to help take advantage of those things.
You've said it, being famous comes with a certain responsibility. Has this been the reason that you changed your research focus from statistics to climate economics?
That's a funny question. The reason I went to graduate school in the first place is that I wanted to do energy economics. I had a job in energy economics. My first job after college was in energy economics. I thought, this is a really cool field. I really like it. So I went to graduate school to be an energy economist. I had about a 20-year detour along the road, but eventually I've tried to turn into an energy and environmental economist. So it's something that I've always enjoyed. And, it is the case that actually my career has had a couple of different phases, one of them focusing a lot on econometric methods and time series and macro type implications, and another one focusing on climate. I don't think that those are necessarily so different. As we think about the problems that the macro economies and the world has been facing, a lot of them in the financial crisis in the 1990s were ones about growth, economic slowdowns, and financial crises and so forth. And we think about what the crises or the challenges are that we're facing today at the macroeconomic level, they're much more related to climate and some of the energy challenges that we're facing internationally. So this actually is, I think, a fairly natural transition.
You put out a massive amount of research, many, many papers. What piece of research are you most proud of?
I actually like a paper of ours that I actually like quite a bit. Is some work I did with Doug Steger that was published in Econometrica in 1997. And what we did in that paper was basically set out a framework that helped us understand what weak instruments actually are, just coined the phrase weak instruments and why that was a relevant thing to think about, and that how that could change one's approach to inference and instrumental variables. And that's been a really useful paper. It's made people understand some of the pitfalls of instrumental variable analysis, and it led to some research that helped people think about how to move forward. There's also there's a lot of other papers that I like. There's a very recent one that is very obscure, and I don't think it has all that many cites, but it came out fairly recently, and I did this one with a couple of colleagues, Kristen McCormick and Doug Irwin. Doug is at Illinois. And we were looking at one of these tradable allowance prices in a very obscure and complicated market. And there were allegations of price gouging and market manipulation. And we were just economists saying it has to be fundamentals. And it was very complicated. We had to do this option pricing thing. And it was quite confusing. But it turned out that the price volatility was perfectly explained by fundamentals.
What do you like most about doing research? Which would be the guide who is just standing in front of his whiteboard for hours and hours doing the math? Or what's the most fun part about research?
Well, you got to love the math on your own. I mean, if you're going to do this sort of thing, you got to love sitting in front of your computer or doing the math on the piece of paper and then getting the results, and that feels really gratifying. But I guess at my point at this point in my career, what feels the most gratifying is actually making contributions that help drive forward efficient and effective climate policy. I deeply believe that we need to deal with the climate crisis, but we're only going to do that if our policies are efficient and effective. So economists play an incredibly important role. We as economists, and especially environmental and climate economists, have a big responsibility here to help the world along the right path so that we are really able to make this decarbonization transition.
You said that you took a detour of 20 years into statistics and econometrics. Looking back, would you say that you should have started to contribute earlier to climate economics?
Well, I suppose we should all look back and we should all say that we should have taken much more aggressive climate action in whatever, mid-80s or 1990. So I guess with the benefit of hindsight, I would have liked to have been, you know, beating the drums here. But, we are where we are right now. And I think I had a lot of fun in my career and did some relevant stuff along the way, but I'm really excited to be able to work in climate and move that forward and to work with students who are interested in climate as well.
What's your explanation for the fact that we didn't care so much about climate economics in the 80s? Why did it take us so long?
Well, you know, it's one thing to have projections that climate damages are going to be happening in the future, and we weren't really seeing too many climate damages in the 1990s or even in the 2000s. I think now we collectively as a society are starting to really see the real world effects of climate change upon us, whether it's the mega drought in the western United States or whether it's flooding in Germany or whether it's this tremendous heat wave that they've been having in India or Pakistan. So I think we're now seeing that these challenges are right here and that we've got to do something with it immediately. Would it have been better if we'd been thoughtful and done policy 25 years ahead in a smooth, optimal way? Of course, but that's not really how political systems or human brains work.
Jim, let me take a final turn here. You wrote the best-selling undergraduate book on econometrics together with Mark Watson from Princeton, who is also a lecturer at the Study Center Gerzensee. You teach many courses at Harvard and in Gerzensee. How does teaching at Harvard and in Gerzensee compare?
So in terms of the facility, this is really a wonderful facility here. It's beautiful. I can go on bike rides or hikes or something and look at the Eiger and so forth. And so that's pretty darn nice. And we don't have those mountains looking at, sitting outside my office window in Cambridge. But the actual teaching, I think that the students are similar to the students at Harvard. And they have, they ask interesting questions and they're engaged in the material. And they want to be able to use this in their PhDs. This is the course I'm teaching now is an advanced PhD program course, and so that's similar to the sort of work that we'd be doing at Harvard. I think one difference is that the students here are probably a little bit more sophisticated in the climate area more educated in the climate area than the students in the United States generally. And I think that that just reflects the fact that much of Europe is maybe in a more mature place right now in terms of talking about climate than much of the United States is.
What has changed most in teaching PhD students since you became a professor?
I think the changes are mainly superficial. The changes are sort of silly ones about how do you use Zoom or how do you use overheads or whatever it is. I think that the actual core interactions that students are smart and they ask really tough questions and they make you think really hard. And, if you're lucky, you can't answer some of the questions and you have to go back and work on it.
Are you saying that you need the same skills to make an academic career today as you did in the 1990s?
Yeah, I think that's fundamentally correct. And I guess the one other, if we're thinking about, what makes a good academic career, what makes a good research life, I think it's fundamentally working on material that you find really interesting and really important. So that's is sort of think about the questions that are really important to you. What contributions can you make to those questions? And that's a different algorithm for doing research as opposed to how can I maximize the number of publications in certain journals. I think those two things are correlated. They're not the same thing. And the research ends up being better if you think about the questions that really matter to you and to the world, and then you try to answer those questions.
Jim, it's absolutely fantastic to have you here in Gerzensee. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
It's my pleasure, and thanks for inviting me.